This is Rod Roberts. The date is July 14th, 1994. And we're interviewing Mr. Art McKinnon in his apartment in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mr. McKinnon, where were you born?
In Oakland, Pittsburgh, down near Forbes Field. 1906.
How many children were in the family?
Two, my brother, who was 8 years older, and myself.
And your father was a
He was a GP, physician for Jones and Lockman Steel for about 30-odd years before he died. He died quite young. He died at 58.
Where had he been born?
He was in Washington, Pennsylvania. The family was, there were six boys and six girls. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was a doctor down there. Two of my father's brothers became physicians, one a nerve specialist and the other one a nose and throat specialist. It's in the family. I always thought I'd be a doctor because I admired my father so much.
I'm not sure. I'm all right. Where did you go to school?
I went to a home school, a grade school, a few blocks from where I lived in Lower Oakland, and graduated from Tinley High School in 1925. I didn't go to college. Father had died, and I felt that I had to go to work because I had my grandmother and mother.
What sort of employment did you get?
Well, of course, I worked at Forbes Field on as a different jobs from the time I was 12. But the first regular job I had really was with a manufacturing chemist by the name of the Zimmer Company. They were right across the street from Forbes Field. And my father had bought some of his medicine from them. That's how I got in on that. Their salesman convinced my mother that it would be a good idea for me to work in a factory for a while and then be put out on the road as a salesman. That's how that came about. And later I changed over and I was working for a stockbroker. I worked during the crash in 1929. That was an experience. I was just a young 20-year-old and quite an experience.
Must have seemed like the world was coming to an end, didn't it?
Yes, I had charge of the disbursements in the K's, the cashier's department. And I was the guy who gave them their money when they brought their stock in to sell it. And that margin business at that time, where you could put up 40% of the cost, and then they'd call you in, and you better get in there, they'd sell you out. And that's where the problems came.
What were these jobs you had at Forbes Field from the age of 12?
Well, my father used to take me to the games when I was about 9 or 10, when I had about 1916 as the first. I remember particularly the Chicago Cubs at 3-2 in that era for one or two reasons. One was that Grover Alexander was pitching for them. My father pointed out to me that he was a great pitcher and there were other good players with that team. Anyway, I got tired of having him pay for me to get in and I wanted to go to more games. So I took my lunch and went over and sat in front of Forbes Field when school was out in 1919. And Billy Southworth came along. He was playing right field for us. And he was the first player to take me in. He took me in and I would go down and sit on the trunks outside the clubhouse until the clubhouse man needed an errand run up to get sandwiches up on Forbes Avenue or take the players' clothes up for pressing or gloves for fixing. And I became their chief errand boy. Then later on, I wanted to go down on the field. That was my bag. So I was made a foul tip boy. I don't think that's a strange term. It was 100 feet in back of the catcher at Forbes Field. And they had to have somebody sit back there and throw the balls up because it was far too far for the catcher to go and get them. And the kid who would have done it, the bad boy, was just always up on the bench, of course. And I worked at that, and then I became bad boy in 1920. I worked there in 1920 and 21 and part of 1922. Then I had a chance to get a paid job. The bad boy wasn't paid. In the scoreboard, which was hand operated. I was the second man. So I shifted over in the middle of 1922 to that, and I worked in that until I left, until I graduated from high school. And of course, the year I graduated, we won the World's Championship. And I was no longer working there because I had shifted over to the Zimmer Company. So in order to see the ball games, the series, I ushered. And of course, we had five games actually. We had that rain out thing. And then later on, I worked off and on in the scoreboard when the Homestead Grays played there. The Pirates were out of town. In fact, the Saturday before I came down with polio, I had a strep throat. And this friend of mine was running the scoreboard at the time full time. And he was at dental school in Pitt. And what I would do, I'd go over and help him and let him keep the money because he needed it for school. And he'd get my help putting up the signs or whatever he had me do. So I worked a doubleheader with the Grays, I think it was the Lincoln Giants that day. And I was paid and I took the money on down and dropped it at Hub's home and went home. And it was that week that I began to notice, it wasn't until the end of that week, really, the following week, when I noticed my legs were a little bit weak when I was playing golf, when I noticed them at Fenley Park. I left after 9 holes that night and went home, and the next day I went back to work at Moore, Leonard & Lynch, the brokers, and I noticed going down the front steps that my back was extremely stiff. So when I got down there, that I finished the day, and I went down to Oakland that night to see if I could get a job ushering at the Duquesne University football games, which were played at the Forbes Field. And I was too sick to stay. I came back up and called my brother from Bouquet Street and Fifth Avenue, just above the ballpark. He came down and got me, and that was the beginning of the end. My mother's birthday, and we had my nephew there. And that drove them crazy later when they realized what I had, because he was climbing all over my bed.
Sure.
And by the Saturday morning, I couldn't draw my legs up in bed. So they came and got me in an ambulance and took me to Municipal Hospital here for contagious diseases, infectious. This is infectious, it is not contagious. And I was in there 3 weeks and came home, and I had very little left except my shoulders. I finally gained the ability to urinate, and my bowels would move, but not at the beginning. They were shut off too. Everything below the waist, really. So I was pretty miserable, and I'd been such an active person. I was very active many ways, and well, my mother and grandmother were there, and they helped me in my recovery. And I didn't get back to Forbes Field till 1942, when they had the electric scoreboard. I used to go in a wheelchair sometimes. I was fortunate enough to be there the Saturday that Ruth hit his 3 home runs, and I was fortunate. You know, there must be 100,000 people say that they saw that. And there were only about 12 or 13,000. So I finally, this friend of mine was the first operator of the electric scoreboard. We had grown up together in Oakland. And things were pretty bad still from the Depression. And he did it in the 1940 and 41, and then he got a job, a regular job. And he said, "Do you want to do this?" So that's how I got on that scoreboard. I began in 1942, and I've run every Pirate scoreboard they ever had. I think the one we ran when I was working it by hand was the original. So up to the time when they just recently put the new scoreboard in, I'd run every board the Pirates ever had. I'm proud of that.
Yeah, you should be. Were those manual scoreboards hot inside?
Oh, like an oven. We used to work in our shorts, that was all. Yeah, we'd take the, sometimes at the ball, certain teams were not playing or the openings in the score, we'd take those metal signs out so the air could get in.
Yeah, I used to see that in Chi Park.
Oh yeah, I was in Chi Park one time. I think it was maybe 1960.
Well, by then it was Connie Mack Stadium.
Yeah, that changed the name. But I was up in that tower, and also I was up in the upper level there. It was a wooden ballpark. And every time they did the rhythmic applause, the whole stand would shake. Yeah. Scare you to death. There was an elevator that took you up to that cupola up the top above the entrance.
And that short right, well, the short,
I was in Baker Bowl.
Oh, Baker Bowl. Oh.
Yeah, that was before. That was I was in Shire Park.
Yeah, Baker Bowl was a...
I was in Baker Bowl in 1929. I went to Atlantic City and we stopped off in Philadelphia. That was a spot, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I was never in Baker Bowl. I know where it was.
It had a short right field like Cleveland.
Yeah.
And if anybody hit a ball up against it, if they could run it all, they had a 2-base hit.
Now, Forbes Field was a
an honest ballpark. Right? I mean, there was nothing cheap about it.
Yeah, it was the biggest, excepting later on in 1932 when they built the Cleveland ballpark. It was, as you can imagine. And then they eventually brought some defense in Cleveland a few times, I think, because center field was just a vast, it was like a moor or something. But fourth field was, you know, that 456, 457. Yeah. Power alley was 375 in right field, and in left field was 406, the power alley.
You'd probably see more triples than anybody, right?
There were a lot of, we used to have a lot of triples, yeah. Philly Doyle, the writer, used to say, most beautiful hit in the game, the triple. It is thrilling, and when Clemente used to run around, it was more thrilling.
Oh, yeah.
His hat would always fall off between second and third, and then he'd spread himself out in that beautiful slide.
Yeah, I guess he was, I didn't see enough Clemente to know, because at that period, like, I was in a service, and I was, things like that. But he must have been some off by the impression he made on this town, at least.
I had a speaking acquaintance with him. He wasn't the most lovable person on earth.
He was very proud, though, and really to the point where he felt he was never appreciated until the 71 World Series when he was the MVP, and he said, now those people in New York know what I can do. Mm-hmm. If he'd been in New York or Chicago or L.A. in the beginning, he would have been far more known, well-known.
I always thought that pride was a little out of overblown, though. I mean, for example, I remember when they were making the movie of The Odd Couple.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted him to hit the triple play.
And he wouldn't do it.
Do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I saw that movie too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little strange, I think. You know?
Oh yeah. Well, that's the way he was.
Yeah.
And he was. He didn't get along too well with some of the writers.
Did he get along with his teammates?
Yes, I think so, although they realized that he had his days. He was a little moody. Somebody asked him one time if he was a hypochondriac, one of the writers. And he said, hypochondriacs don't produce. I produce.
I remember one time also he got in trouble with some fans and fell off at the end of the bus after a game or something. He was going to hit somebody.
He could have, yeah. He could have.
Yeah, I guess he wasn't the most lovable, but certainly.
No, but he was a great family man. Yeah. He lived up here about four blocks for a while, and at Penn and Negley. I wasn't intimate with him, but he was always extremely nice to me. I was somewhat sometimes in a wheelchair and sometimes on the crutches, and very gracious. Introduced me to his wife at Forbes Field before they were married. And she couldn't even speak English. All she did was bow and smile. Vera.
His boy didn't make it, did he?
No, he tried. He was in our system, I think, for a while. You know, I was just wondering what happened to the third boy. During this celebration here, Rod, they had the other two boys, the older boys, apparently, but he didn't show and nobody said anything about him. He had three boys.
Yeah.
I'm sure one of them didn't die. We'd have heard of him. I think one of them was a musician, and it may have been that boy who was not here. His top brother, Roberto Jr., has been doing a lot of speaking around here.
Oh.
And there's a foundation set up in the William Penn Hotel, Roberto Clemente Foundation, which is sponsoring baseball leagues and things of that kind in Pittsburgh now. They have their own offices.
I've been listening to the talk show since I've been here, and I mean the way that people talk about Clemente. I mean, I heard a man say, "I don't pay attention to baseball since Clemente's gone."
It's like a lot of people I hear that tell me they've never been to Three Rivers.
Yeah.
They miss Forbes Field so much they don't even care to go over there.
Well, the experience is totally different.
Oh yeah,
all-purpose ballpark, completely different.
Although, when we left Forbes Field, it was a tired old ballpark. The University of Pittsburgh had bought it, and they weren't going to fix it up or spend much money on it. So when we got over to Three Rivers in 1970, it was like heaven.
Oh, sure.
The facilities were so much greater, and there wasn't all this yapping about all-purpose ballpark and turf and everything. Actually, those sight lines at Three Rivers are much better for football than they are for baseball.
Yeah.
There's seats there for baseball, it shouldn't be sold, I really think.
Yeah. Well, Forbes Field didn't have a neighborhood problem, did it? They did.
Neighborhood? I mean, a bad neighborhood?
Yeah.
No.
No,
see, the University of Pittsburgh was on one side, Carnegie Mellon on the other, and a large area of middle-income people on the other side, you might say. And many more places to eat, of course, and you could get off a streetcar or a bus and walk one block and you were there. Two main streets are only two blocks, one block and two blocks away, Forbes Avenue and Fifth. And, of course, the parking was very bad.
Whereas Connie Mack Stadium, I mean, they had to tear it. They couldn't do anything with that site because it was surrounded by a ghetto, you know, and there was no place to park, and people had crime problems.
North Philadelphia, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there, as I said.
Yeah. Well, I'd much rather watch a ball game in an old ballpark, but I don't want to have my car stolen while I'm watching it,
No, we didn't have a problem there. University of Pittsburgh with their stadium up on the hill there, they're very close to what might be described as a ghetto. But there hasn't been too much of that. What they did at Pitt, they were smart. They let the neighborhood kids and people use the gym when they weren't using it, the field house. And I think that was a very wise thing.
Did you operate the electric scoreboards from?
Right there. It's in back of home plate.
In a
balcony that was put in when the Galbraith people came Galbraith, McKinney, Johnson, and Bing Crosby. There was no such place as you see there. That was put in between the second and first tiers. And Bob Prince sat just to the left there, and Rosie Rosewell before him, just beside that white post. I could hear everything they said. But the place was like a bird cage. I remember the head of the Western Union there, who was in charge of the machines and things that the writers used, operators used for the writers' stories, used to say, why didn't they ask someone who has sat in press boxes before they built this thing? There were girders in there like this that you had to duck under. They had what they called a purple heart for writers that would come in and hit their heads before they got out of there. I know a priceless little vignette about that. One night I was working a Homestead Gray game, a twilight game, and a couple of fellas came up just to sit in the press box. They wanted to see what it was like. And I didn't bother them. They were over with it. One of them got up to leave, and he bumped his head on the first girder. Then he went up the steps and went through the cross girders, and he bumped his head again. He turned around, looked at me, and he said, geez, you're going to be a ventriloquist to come out of this place. I tried to get Les Biederman to use it. He would never use it.
That's great. the Homestead Grays, you saw a lot of their ball games.
Yeah, I saw them before they really became famous. The Monarch, Kansas City Monarchs and all the Indianapolis Clowns would come in. What a night that would be. And the Philadelphia... I can't think of the name of that team in Philadelphia. Baltimore, they used to call the Baltimore Elite Giants.
Yeah.
And the New York team, whatever that was. I can't think of that name of the Philadelphia.
I can't either. And I saw their games.
Yeah, oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Was it wasn't a common name. It was a name that I've never heard since. Of course, they when the Kansas City Monarchs would play there, I think Banks played for the Kansas City Monarchs, didn't he?
I think so.
And I think he played a game at Forbes Field. I know I saw him in that league shortly before he was picked up by, I guess the Cubs picked him up. I think so. Very pleasant person.
You saw Gibson play then, did you?
Oh, yeah, when he was a rookie.
Was he as good a player as they say?
Well, you know, his hitting has been blown up out of proportion, I think, but he was a tremendous hitter. Very solidly built, not very over tall, just an average height. Come Posey, I knew. He allowed me to sit on the bench with him, and I was the only white person there. I was very proud of. Come was very light skinned, but he had a great team there. And this is before the '30s, when most of the notoriety of the Grays came along. And then of course the Crawfords came in, and they had a lot of those players too later on. But Gibson, I remember a remark that Come Posey made about him when he was playing. It's an odd remark. It has to do with the way he took the ball. He said, you see how that kid folds him?
And I guess it was the way he would take that ball and turn that glove around. And of course he was on his way then. And, they say he hit the ball over Forbes Field center field fence. That is wrong. He may have done it. I did not see that. The only two that I know of who ever played in the major leagues were Jim Wynn, the toy cannon from Houston, and Dick Stewart. I saw both of those. And to my knowledge, other than Gibson's, if he did hit it over there, nobody ever hit it over there from the time I went to work there in the late teens. Because we used to sit there as kids and say, nobody was ever going to hit that ball over the center field fence.
Jim Wynn did, though, huh?
Jim Wynn hit it, yeah. Not a big man.
No, no.
He didn't have a long career, did he? Jimmy Wynn didn't have a long career.
No, not
7, 8 years.
Neither did Stewart, for that matter.
Oh, no. No.
Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, he had an interesting career.
Yes, he did. We were over in Columbus. I flew over with the Pirates. The first time I ever flew in 1959 to the Galbraith Estate. Marvelous place. They had an enclosed track for the horses, where they were all enclosed. They had pheasant runs, and they had a pool there and everything. Oh my goodness, quite an estate. And a rumpus woman that had a stage in it. Jack Berger, our PR man, wanted me to see the estate. And of course I was unable to walk around, but so he got a Thunderbird there from somebody and he put me in and he got Dick Stewart to drive me all over the estate. So I got to know Dick pretty well. Very personable kind of a guy. That was a strange team.
Yeah, I guess it was.
That had Rocky Nelson, I think, too. Yeah. And I remember the little story about Rocky getting caught off second base one time. He came into the bench and somebody said to him, what the hell did you do that for? How did you get caught? He said, what do you think they call me Rocky for? Pretty frank.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a character too, I guess.
Yeah, I got to know Dick Stewart pretty well.
Yeah.
I knew Clemente fairly well. He, as I say, he was always gracious with me. I was older, you know. I was no chicken at the time. And the story was that they tried to keep him off the field when scouts would come to Montreal. He was in the Brooklyn chain. And Branch Rickey was trying to hide him there. And when Branch Rickey got here, he soon had him in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
That's a story that I suppose is true. I've heard it so many times.
I'm sure they hit a lot of ball players in those days.
Yeah, and you, well, of course, Rickey wrote the book. Mm-hmm. He used to hide them down there in St. Louis until, I guess it was Landis came in and broke it up. He would, he had a lot of ball players there that should have been in the majors long before they were, and then they had to do something about the farm thing.
Yeah. Well, you say since you watched the Pirates since 1916.
Yeah, my dad began to take me when I was about 9 or 10, and before that, I just wasn't into it, I guess, because I can't remember anything much before that. But they had a team there that, they had Holliker and Herzog and Flack and Paskert and Killifer, and they still, some of them still played. Bill Killifer was still catching when I was bat boy. Mm-hmm. And I remember Herzog, he used to holler, knock him down to Charlie, as a second baseman. And I think they had, I thought they had Merkel, but I think they had Merkel. And let's see, who was the center fielder? I think it was Dode Paskert. And Max Flack was in right. Horace Mann was in left. Chuck Deal was on third. Charlie Holliker was at short. And of course, as I said, I think they had a big guy. No, he pitched for the Giants, Fred Tony. He had this stride when he was walking off the mound, and the people had this funny stride that the people in the stands would holler, hip, hip, hip. And of course, I got to know Babe Adams pretty well. I used to catch in for him when he was hitting the outfield. He said, where's my boy? And I'd come over and catch in. Oh boy, he had 3 wins in the World Series, 1909. Famous boy. Nice man. They said he had a pulse rate, natural rate of 58. He was very low key and came from Mobile, Raya, Missouri. Being bad boy for that 1921 team, Rod, was a circus because there was not too much serious play with that crowd. They got away out front in 7.5 games in the last part of August,
and went to New York and lost a whole 5-game series, and they never recovered. The Giants beat them out. Whole 5-game. We were in mourning at 7.5-game lead in August. So I was close to that team. They had Rabbit Moranville and Cotton Tierney and Boston Whitted, Charlie Grimm, first base, Carson Bigby, Max Carey, who was a captain. I got to know all those people real well, really.
They called me Mac. My name is actually Arthur, Art. Most people call me Art.
Rabbit Moranville, he was a character.
He was a daisy. They said he dove in the Copley Plaza fountain one time up there in Boston. Well, Bob Prince dove out a window in St. Louis into the swimming pool.
Did he?
That's actually happened, I know that. Yeah, some of the guys, you know, the Prohibition was in. And some of the guys knew the spots. I can take you right to a couple now. One was a drugstore right near where my father wrote his prescriptions for that drugstore. And there was back counter stuff. And then there was one in back of a place that's called it's a restaurant in Oakland, Atwood Street between Forbes and Fifth. And this place was right back by the Strand Theater where you could go back and get your moonshine. Some of those guys overdid it. Johnny Morrison.
There was a lot of drinking in baseball in those days, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was a different thing.
Yeah.
You've got so many more family men now playing ball, and many more college men. Those days, it was pretty rugged. I know I could swear as well as a sea captain when I was 13 just being around that clubhouse.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Robin Roberts told me that off the field, profanity almost never crosses his lips. You know, he just doesn't resort to it. They said, put on a uniform, and every other word is.
Oh, I'd hate to tell you what we call Dazzy Vance. It wouldn't look good. Dazzy Vance, he used to be our nemesis. He and Art Neff. Vance, Pittsburgh, Brooklyn. They made up a song about him, the Dodgers. Daz Marie, the Brooklyn Ace. Has a big head, but look at his face. When he dates the Village Queen, all the boys get up their spleen. Bunch of characters there, too. Pete Kilduff and Ivy Olson. And, oh my goodness, who was the first place? I can't remember that. I have an encyclopedia in here that goes way back, but it's too heavy to get out. I had a lot of fun when I was a boy with those tourist figures, particularly in 1920, 21, 22.
Did you ever play ball?
I couldn't hit. You know, I could feel and throw because they gave me the chance to do that at the games, at the practices before the games. I could throw pretty accurately, and I had a strong arm, and I was a good fielder, but nobody ever handed you a bat in those days and said, go up and take your swings, because everybody was jealous of their swings.
Sure. Still are, I guess, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. You see a batting practice, and it's coming to a close. You see those guys get in there for one swing.
Yeah, sure.
I was small, too. I wasn't very big when I was in high school.
Now, Polly Trainer was around for a long time when you were here.
Yeah, I helped him get a room in Oakland when he first came. He was the rawest looking thing you ever saw in your life. Not neat and big, wide shoulders. It looked like he's right in that picture there.
Yeah.
On the end toward the cupboard in the second row, sitting there with a crew cut. That's the 25 World Championship.
Uh-huh.
That was an amazing game at 7th. Talk about 60.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, we had been down like we were in a couple of the Baltimore series that we had here, 3-1, as I recall. And we came back, of course, and evened it. And the final game was to be played here. It was the odd year. We played in the American League in the even year. And this was 1925, rather. And it rained. We had to call the game off. Final day, and then they played the next day. Yeah, you're doing a lot of stuff too. You get me started. I have a habit of, yeah.
That's what I'm here for.
an improvement over the old one. I had a tape recorder one time here, about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh boy, it was so heavy you can hardly carry it.
80 pounds, yeah. I carry those around.
I bet. Yeah, I look at those cameramen these days, so I don't see how some of them carry all that stuff.
Well, you're talking about the 25 series.
Oh yeah, and we had to face Walter Johnson again. I think he was even with us at the time. I believe we beat him, and then he beat us. And he was started in the seventh game, probably shouldn't have been because he wasn't himself. They got out front, and then we came back. Of all things, I was actually sitting in a section where Mrs. Walter Johnson was. I never saw anybody so nervous in my life, any more nervous. Well, anyhow, I came up to the the eighth inning, and the score was tied, 7-7. And Kyler got up, our right field, Hazen Kyler, Kyler. And the bases were full. And he fouled a number of pitches off. You know, you're in stitches then. And finally, he hit one down the right field line, and it was fair, and it bounced over in back of the canvas. And everybody scored, and the people thought it was a home run on the bases. Well, actually, it was a ground rule double. But that's how we finished, and people went crazy.
Yeah.
And what happened after the game, anyway, it was 9-7 final. We had a pitcher by the name of Oldham, a reliever, which weren't too numerous in those days. A reliever wasn't what he is now. And he came in and struck out two of them. I think Harris and Goslin were two of them, so two of the best hitters they had. The manager actually, Bucky Harris. And of course, Goslin was their big man. He didn't do much in that series. So that was it, and then the crowd was in left. We put them on the field there, out in left field with a special bunch of seats in front of the fence. They had built some extra bleachers there. And those people just pushed the fences down, and there was a little band, and that band marched right in toward the home plate with this gang of people, and it was mud, almost, I won't say ankle deep, but it rained the entire game that day, drizzled. Story goes that the groundkeeper for the Pirates, when he went out to the mound to fix it up on account of the rain, he put sand out there with our guy and didn't try to help the other people too much.
Groundskeeping has won a lot of ball games over the years.
Yeah, Jack Fogarty was a guy who was an institution here, fine ground. Of course, it was all for her grass.
Raise and lower the mound depending on who was pitching?
I'm not sure that they did that, but I suspected them of altering the baseline some, depending on. You know, we pulled canvas at that time.
Uh-huh.
It was really canvas. Yeah. Now, I guess it's nylon.
Yeah.
But they tried to, a big storm would come and they'd get that canvas partway out, and I've seen them stop right in the middle of the infield because the thing was entirely too heavy to pull any further. Uh-huh. They had a whole troop of men. I thought I'd get out there one day and big little canvas for us, and I got caught under the thing. And I was a big mess.
Yeah.
I remember what a terrible feeling was to be just for a minute or so under that canvas, and then, of course, somebody noticed, they pulled it back, and I got out. I had to go home and take all my clothes off. I was completely mud.
Yeah.
I'd look at that guy who does that on a commercial now or somewhere.
Yeah.
It happened in Miami, I think, or I'm not entirely sure, but I know they had some fun down in Miami one night with that kind of thing. And he gets caught, and then he comes back out and brushes himself off. I said, well, brother, I had to do more than that.
Well, that happened in Cooperstown a few years ago. The first time, you know, they had never had a park to cover the field there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there got to be so much money in this Hall of Fame thing, they invested in the park.
Yeah.
And the first time they used it, the night before the game, there's supposed to be showers. And they sent an emergency call out to the village crew for manpower. Mm-hmm. Some of them had been drinking.
Oh, boy.
And they routed them out of a bar to come in, and they got out there. And they finally got it laid out there. And when they got finished, there was this lump out by second base.
Somebody under there. Oh, for goodness sake. Oh, they revived them.
Well, they got him.
A lump.
He was too drunk to know.
A horrible thing.
Yeah. So when I see that commercial, I always think of Bobby Buzzy, who was the lump under that.
I was in Cooperstown in 74.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, trip up there. We drove all the way clear through. That's a murderous trip from here, 400 and some miles.
Yeah.
We couldn't get a room anywhere. We tried to stop in, what was it? We tried at Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, and we couldn't get any rooms. It was wet Labor Day weekend is the reason. And we got up there. We had to stay at an old hotel. We had got the last room. We had been turned down over the telephone trying to call motels. And we got the last room, and the air conditioner made so much noise we couldn't sleep. It was just an old hotel. Had a porch out on it. It was Lake Oak, Lake, what is it?
Otsego,
yeah. Well, it was a hotel that was right beside the lake, an old wooden, like a summer hotel.
Yeah, the other side.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only hotel in town, unfortunately, now.
Is that so?
Yeah.
It's still there, then. Well, oh, darn, I thought it'd be gone by now.
No, it's still there.
I was in one like that in Toledo one time, summer hotel, they call it. Went over from Cleveland on a boat.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time in Cleveland looking at games. I had relatives there. Oh. I used to drive to go up, beginning in 1946, I went up for six, seven years in a row just to see American League Baseball, mm-hmm. because we didn't have television.
Right.
And Feller was in his heyday. And our man from Pittsburgh here, who's in Montcander, went to Central High, pitched for Cleveland. Flight pitcher, and he got into some trouble and alcohol, and now he's going around counseling people in alcohol.
Same time as Feller? Stan Feller or later?
No, it was around the time of Feller. Around the time.
I
can't think of his name. He's right from Morningside here. He's a counselor now. I think it's his business. I'll think of it before you leave.
Trainer was here for you knew Trainer for a long time.
Oh yeah. Call me Art.
Art.
Hello, Art.
Where was he from?
Somerville, Massachusetts.
Somerville, Massachusetts.
They called him Pie because he liked pie.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was the brief explanation.
How about the Wainers?
Well, two different people.
Yeah.
Yeah, Paul, unfortunately, drank a little too much. Lloyd, I don't think ever touched it. Mm-hmm. Lloyd was one of those pure personalities. Mm-hmm. Married a local girl from Oakland, daughter of a flower shop lady, had a flower shop. Ada, Oklahoma, two corn cobs with each other, and tried to hit them, and that's the old story about them, how the corn cobs darted this way and that. Mm-hmm. Taught them to hit curve balls and things. Mm-hmm. One of the stories about Paul when he, after he even left the Pirate team, I hate it. He was such a great player, and he said a ball looked like a grapefruit to him. And he would foul him off. He just pushed the ball down the third base line if he didn't want to hit it. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be a strike. Push it down the third base line. I remember he went to camp, I think it was in 1925, with the Pirates, and in 1926, and he asked him if he could bring his little brother along, who was a second baseman somewhere in California, or in Oklahoma. That was Lloyd. Mm-hmm. Can I bring my little brother along? Famous words. And the two of them were there for years, of course, fellas. Lloyd Wainer, P. Wainer, Vaughn, and Trainer.
I got to interview Lloyd Wainer.
Did you?
But unfortunately, he had just broken his hip in his final accident, and he was in a hospital, and supposedly he was all right, but he couldn't maintain a train of thought at all.
Isn't that too bad?
Yeah.
He run like a deer. Well, he would cover that out, too. We've had some great center fielders. Max Carey, Lloyd Wainer, Andy Vince, like, many in the clip. Verdon, Bill Verdon.
Yeah.
We even had Dom DiMaggio out there.
Did you?
great fielder.
Yeah, he was a great fielder.
Most, struck out most poetically of anybody I've ever seen. The only one that struck out more poetically was Larry Doby, as far as I'm concerned, when he first came up. I was in Cleveland some of the years when he first came up. They called him Lara. The black community over there is pretty big, and he was a great favorite. First black player in the American League.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember his first trip into Philadelphia, he got in the head with a fly ball.
Oh, really? Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly became a great ball player.
Oh, he did, yeah. Everyone wanted to see this black ball player.
Yeah, Jackie Robinson came here. The black fans used to come up to the window over Forbes Field. I need a couple of tickets for Robinson's game. It didn't matter when it was or what it was. Robinson's game.
What was the reaction when Robinson came in among the ball players?
Well, some of them resisted him, I think. I don't think Dixie Walker was in there. I think Pee Wee Reese took up for him.
Yeah.
I think you'll find that out.
Story, yeah.
Did you interview him?
No. I'm going to this weekend.
He took up for him, and of course, they had problems. I ran into a fellow at the concert, this all-star concert down Saturday night at Pittsburgh Symphony, and he wants to talk to me about Moses Yellow Horse, the Indian pitcher who pitched for us in 1921 and 22. And, well, you can imagine, he was dark-skinned, of course, an Indian, and he was. He maintained he was a full-blooded Pawnee Indian. I don't know whether he's a chief or not, but he was full-blooded, and he had trouble getting a room in Oakland. And I think he was unsuccessful until one of the white pitchers agreed to room with him, and that enabled him to, in other words, they felt that it was so terrible at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Different toilets and different restaurants, and goodness gracious.
Yeah.
The reaction was slow to change. Of course, he was such a star himself that he attracted people. And Branch Rickey would be the one, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
I think some of his family still lives here, out in Fox Chapel.
Huh?
Mary Rickey, what a nice lady, Jimmy's daughter. His son died early, unfortunately, of diabetes. Branch Jr., nice fellow, came here. We had a terrible team at that time, calling the Ricky Dink. Joe Garagiola wasn't wrong. He did the emceeing for the workout day the other day on the old timers game. Yeah, on the field.
Yeah, I heard people on the talk shows here enjoyed that too.
Yes, they did. A lot of people were able to get to that and see some of the players because they had batting practice after the old timers game, and then they had this home run hitting contest. So a lot of people who weren't able to get tickets for the regular game were able to get in there. The place was jammed. There was over 50,000 there. I was over to that. I wonder if you'd turn that off at the wall. It seems to be giving me a stiff neck.
Really?
You, at the wall. I think it's cooled off a little bit outside. That'll slow down now. Thank you.
Well, I think the best thing they can do for the All-Star game is to have games like that, like that one the other night.
Oh, boy.
That was a great game.
Yeah, they couldn't say that was boring.
No. Nope.
Many's the All-Star game I've seen written up as boring.
Yeah, that one wasn't.
I worked the first three here. I worked the scoreboard in 44. I did the announcing and the scoreboard both in 1959 and 74. I was most proud of that lot of anything that I've done in connection with scoreboards and work at the ballpark, was that I was able to run both the scoreboard and do the announcing for two All-Star games and three, let's see, in 60, 71, and 79, the World Series.
Mm-hmm. It's not easy to run a scoreboard and to...
Well, you've got to keep your wits about you. You've got to count, and then you've got to, I will say this, in 71, they had a telephone down in back of home plate at the screening, and Ed Sudol was the plate umpire. He would come back.